Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a massive stack of sources, articles, interviews, and deep research and give you the fast track to being the most informed person in the room.
Uh-huh.
Today, we're undertaking a deep dive into a career that serves as, well, kind of a blueprint for the modern comedic polymath, Jennifer Ann Kirkman.
Yeah, it's more than just a path, isn't it? It's really a masterclass in professional transmutation, you could say.
Transmutation, I like that.
Jen Kirkman, she successfully navigated the whole high-stakes world of stand-up, you know?
Man.
Then mastered the volatile field of television writing.
Which is notoriously tough.
Exactly. Yep. Then crossed over to become a New York Times bestselling author, and then sort of circled back to lend her technical comedic expertise as a consultant on prestige television, no less.
Right. And when you look at her public profile, most people probably know her from, well, two main things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being that regular, super quick roundtable panelist on Chelsea lately. She did, what, 70 episodes over 6 years?
Yeah, a huge run.
And, of course, her incredibly unique and, frankly, unforgettable appearances narrating on Drunk History.
Absolutely. Those are iconic. But what's truly fascinating and what we're trying to unpack today is the architectural complexity of that career.
Okay.
While her stand-up always remained the core skill, you know, the professional infrastructure she built around it demanded skills far beyond just performing.
Like what specifically?
Well, ranging from the foundational training she got in acting way back to her more recent, quite technical role writing specific, period-appropriate stand-up punchlines for a character on the marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
That's a really interesting point, the range there.
It is.
So our mission today is to really analyze exactly how she leveraged that singular observational comedic voice across such diverse and sometimes kind of contradictory platforms.
Yeah, turning personal vulnerability into published success and technical expertise, it's quite the journey.
Okay, let's start at the beginning then, the origin story. Jennifer Ann Kirkman, born August 28, 1974, Needham, Massachusetts.
Yep, youngest of three sisters. And the sources mention her heritage is actually quite diverse. German, Polish, French-Canadian, English, you know, deep New England roots.
Right. But you mentioned something earlier that feels more critical to her professional delivery than geography.
Yeah, absolutely. It's her college training. She didn't study English or communications, which you might expect. She majored in acting at Emerson College in Boston.
Oh, okay.
And that foundational training in performance and theatrical presence, that's really crucial, I think.
How so? How does that acting background specifically, you know, show up in her stand-up style later on?
Well, it provides precision. Stand-up, especially the kind Kirkman does, that deeply observational personal style, it relies heavily on characterization, on vocal control.
Okay.
The Emerson training, it means her delivery is often less, maybe, aggressive and more finely tuned to emotional nuance compared to comics who just came up purely through open mics.
Right, I see that.
It helps her connect the emotional core of her material, you know, the sadness, the anxiety, with the comedic timing needed for the punchline. That precision, it definitely allowed her to move pretty seamlessly into later voice work and even scripted roles.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And her stand-up presence itself, that started relatively early, active since 97.
Yeah, since 1997. And once she moved out to Los Angeles, she, like, immediately planted herself in those key performance hubs, the ones defining that whole burgeoning alt-comedy scene at the time.
Okay, so which venues are we talking about?
Well, yeah, the distinction is kind of important. We're talking regular spots at the Hollywood Improv and the Laugh Factory, you know, the traditional club circuit.
Sure.
But also the alternative, more narrative-focused places like Largo and the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, UCB.
Ah, UCB, right.
So this duality, performing in both kinds of spaces, it suggests she was constantly balancing, you know, the need for broad club-friendly material with the more nuanced, character-driven storytelling that the alt scene really valued.
And she wasn't just working solo in these rooms. She was collaborating pretty quickly with people who became huge names.
Oh, yeah, right away. The sources track her performing with major figures who basically define this modern era of comedy. People like Maria Bamford, Mike Birbiglia.
Wow.
And crucially, Chelsea Handler.
Okay, that Handler connection feels key.
It was absolutely career-defining. It went from just working the same rooms to actually performing on the Comedians of Chelsea Lately tour, both in 2009 and 2010.
Right.
This integration, it meant she wasn't just some opening act anymore. She was being marketed as part of a recognized, established comedic brand. That gave her consistent visibility that, honestly, many rising comics just don't get.
Now, here's something that seems like an early indicator of her maybe strategic thinking. and that community focus long before she was a bestseller. In 2001, she co-founded GirlComic.net with Becky Donahue.
Yes, and this was very early for that kind of targeted digital community building.
It seems pioneering, right?
Totally pioneering. And it speaks directly to her like mission-driven approach. Even back then, the intention was specific. Encourage girls and women to write funny stories. And importantly, to actively combat the pretty pervasive sexism that really characterized a lot of the club comedy environment at the time.
So an intentional effort to showcase and elevate female voices.
Exactly.
And they backed it up with credibility, too, didn't they? Interviewing established, pioneering female comics.
Yeah, big names like Joy Behar, Amy Poehler, Sarah Silverman.
Wow.
Precisely. They were creating this kind of positive reinforcement loop. And, you know, while the mission was focused on women's perspectives, the sources do confirm they included men on the site, too.
Okay.
So it was about inclusion and encouragement, not really exclusion.
But if it was such a pivotal mission-driven idea, why did it eventually fade away? The updates stopped in 2003, and the whole site closed in 2006. What happened there?
Well, that short lifespan is actually pretty instructive, I think. It tells you about the demands of the early internet versus the demands of being a touring stand-up comic.
Right, juggling both.
Exactly. It was clearly a passion project, but one requiring constant upkeep, nonstop production of fresh material. All while both creators were trying to build performing careers in what's already a grueling industry.
Sure.
It just shows how hard it is to sustain that kind of non-performance community work early on. But importantly, the themes that drove GirlComic.net, fighting sexism, highlighting unique female experiences, those are the exact same themes that would later make her books bestsellers.
Ah, interesting connection.
Yeah, the idea didn't really die. It just found a more, let's say, profitable and sustainable outlet in her narrative prose later on.
That foundation of digital savvy, though, it certainly paid off down the line. By 2009, she was already getting formal recognition, named one of the top 12 rising stars in comedy by Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah, and this momentum carried directly into the digital world where she'd already built some credibility. In May 2010, you had two major outlets, MSN and the Huffington Post, both naming her a top comedian to follow on Twitter.
That recognition is really key, isn't it? It suggests her observational humor just translated perfectly to that, you know, 140 character limit of early Twitter.
Absolutely. It wasn't just about jokes. It was about connecting.
Right.
It's a crucial insight, I think. Twitter demands immediacy, precision, and a high volume of quality short form stuff. That skill set, it's the same one you need for roundtable panel comedy.
Uh-oh.
So she was connecting with her audience outside the traditional club structure and at the same time, basically training for what would become her defining television role.
Okay, so that blend of digital smarts and consistent club work, it feeds directly into her most visible role. The regular roundtable panelist on East Chelsea lately,
mm-hmm.
70 episodes, that's just consistent high-level exposure over 6 years, an unbelievable platform for honing that quick reactive wit.
Oh, definitely. The panel format is such a unique high-pressure machine, you know?
Yeah.
You have to react incredibly quickly, often to pop culture news you might not even care about that deeply.
Right.
And land a punchline in a tiny fraction of the time you'd get on stage. That experience, it honed her technical writing skills immensely. Mm. But here's where we see the volatility of the entertainment industry really hit hard.
Okay, walk us through that major pivot she made in 2010.
Right. So June 3rd, 2010, Kirkman announces she's leaving the whole Chelsea Lately setup, panelist, staff writer, everything.
Wow.
To take a major leap, joining the writing staff for NBC's romantic sitcom, Perfect Couples.
NBC, primetime. Big move.
Huge move. From cable, where she was established, to broadcast primetime network TV. That was seen at the time as a significant step up, you know, prestige, potential stability.
That sounds like a massive career risk, though, leaving guaranteed work on a hit show for an uncertain sitcom slot.
It absolutely was a gamble. And the risk, well, it materialized almost immediately.
Now and then.
Perfect Couples premiered in January 2011, highly anticipated. But network comedy slots are just brutal. By March 11, 2011, so less than 3 months after its premiere, NBC had already pulled it from the schedule.
Wow, that fast.
That fast. It was a swift, harsh lesson in the life of a television writer.
A quick 3-month turnaround really shows the speed at which those high-stakes network jobs can just vanish. But The resilience is what stands out here.
Exactly. And the silver lining is that the relationships she built back at Chelsea lately were strong enough to support her immediate return.
Oh, okay.
By April 2011, she was back on the writing staff there, continuing to make occasional panel appearances throughout late 2010 and well after the NBC show collapsed.
So she landed on her feet.
She did. And she also appeared regularly on the spinoff After Lately, which gave that kind of fictionalized, self-aware view of the behind-the-scenes chaos. This whole episode, the pivot, the failure, the return, it's like a perfect little anecdote for understanding the adaptability and, frankly, the networking required for survival in comedy writing.
Absolutely. Now, beyond the Lately universe, her other major narrative highlight, the one that probably introduced her to an even wider audience, was Drunk History.
Yes.
This is where that precise performance training meets, well, deliberate chaos.
It's such a remarkable format, isn't it? It relies entirely on the narrator's charisma and their comedic structure, somehow fighting through the inebriation.
Right.
She narrated for both the original Funny or Die sketch series and then the later Comedy Central TV show. That sketch series episode specifically got huge acclaim. It won the jury prize for best short film at the 2010 Sundance Film Festival.
Wow, Sundance.
Okay.
And the detail that gives the show its authentic edge. Were the narrators actually drunk?
Yes. The sources confirm this essential chaotic detail. Kirkman herself confirmed she was actually drunk for both episodes she narrated.
Okay, so she wasn't just performing drunk.
No. She was attempting to recall and narrate historical facts while maintaining the comedic beat, all in an altered state. It's actually a real testament to the structural inherent comedy in her writing that it could survive that kind of delivery.
That's incredible. And her broader visibility was pretty widespread too, right? She wasn't just stuck on cable.
Not at all. She had guest spots on virtually every major talk show. Conan, The View, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. She also performed stand-up on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson and popped up on comedy game shows like At Midnight.
Okay, so she was covering all the bases.
Absolutely. This wide-ranging TV exposure, it demonstrates a really comprehensive career strategy. She was hitting all the required comedic media voice work, like on home movies and super news,
right.
Panel punditry on Lately, sketch comedy, even on that short-lived 2007 show Acceptable TV on VH1.
Oh yeah, I vaguely remember that.
And pure stand-up performance on the late-night circuit.
Yeah.
She basically ensured that no matter which channel you were watching, you were probably going to run into her work somewhere.
That consistent exposure must have boosted her recorded work. She started with self-help back in 2006.
Yep. And her follow-up, Hail to the Freaks, which came out in 2011, that was a real commercial success. It peaked at number 13 on the Billboard Top Comedy Albums chart.
Number 13, that's solid.
It is. And it's important to note the timing here. This recorded success validated her stand-up material right when her visibility on Chelsea Lately was at its absolute peak.
Ah, synergy.
Exactly. TV drove the album sales, proving the synergy of her different platforms.
Then came the pivot to, well, the ultimate streaming platform, yeah. Netflix. Her album, I'm Gonna Die Alone and I Feel Fine, released in 2016, that also served as her debut stand-up feature on Netflix, right?
Correct. And this transition from the traditional audio album model to a streamed video special model. It's like a textbook example of adapting to how media was changing.
For sure.
The Netflix platform just expanded her reach dramatically. It put her intimate, highly personal stand-up in front of a global audience.
Huge potential audience there.
Massive. Mm-hmm. And she quickly leveraged that success too with her second stand-up feature for Netflix, Just Keep Living. That premiered in January 2017 and was later released as an album in November 2018. The ability to just churn out quality, deeply personal material consistently across all these formats, that's a huge part of her career architecture.
Okay, so this brings us to her transition from performer-writer to, like, a bona fide published author, leveraging those stand-up themes for long-form narrative. In 2013, she hits literary success with her debut book, I Can Barely Take Care of Myself, Tales from a Happy Life Without Kids.
Yes. And this is where that thematic consistency really pays off big time. The book wasn't just popular. It like hit a cultural nerve, became a New York Times nonfiction bestseller.
Wow. Bestseller status.
Huge. And the topic, examining a happy, fulfilled life without children, it was deeply personal, totally observational, but also controversial enough to generate massive discussion.
Yeah, I remember that, sparking conversations.
It took the intimacy of her stand-up, which often touches on social norms and anxiety, and just expanded it into a full-length exploration. It instantly elevated her status beyond just the comedy scene.
And she recognized that success and followed up pretty quickly, didn't she? Signed another book deal.
Yep. Second book deal with Simon and Schuster. That second memoir, I Know What I'm Doing, and Other Lies I Tell Myself. Dispatches from a Life Under Construction came out in April 2016.
So cementing her role as an author.
Absolutely. And what's important here is the sheer versatility in her comedic writing. She wasn't just writing stand-up or memoirs. She also contributed several published essays to popular collections like Rejected, Tales of the Failed, Dumped and Canceled, and Bad Sex. We did it, so you don't have to.
Okay.
This just confirms her ability to write effectively across any narrative length, from a quick joke to a panel quip to a focused essay, all the way up to a full-length book.
All right, let's track back to her original scripted writing for the screen. She has animation credits.
Yeah, writing for kids, which is interesting. Two episodes of the Disney Channel series Phineas and Ferb back in 2009, plus continued voiceover work on animated shows like Home Movies and Super News.
Writing for Disney Channel seems like such a different muscle than her stand-up.
Totally different. It requires a specific, structured humor that contrasts sharply with her usual dark, observational style. But now we see the pivot to creator, trying to build her own universe based directly on those successful memoir themes.
Okay, tell us about that.
In November 2013, FX gave her a script deal for a show just called Jen.
Jen?
Yeah.
Simple enough.
Oh.
What was the concept? It sounds like it might be a direct translation of her book.
It was almost a perfect mirror, yeah. Set in Boston, her hometown, and focused on a recently divorced woman in her mid-30s.
Okay, hitting all her key themes.
Exactly, and the backing was significant. Chelsea Handler, Tom Brunel, Brad Wallach, all executive producing. The concept was clearly attempting to capture that zeitgeist of her best-selling memoir and transition it into a scripted, running sitcom. Which is, you know, the ultimate goal for many successful comics.
Right, the sitcom deal. And even after that project didn't quite move forward, she tried again a few years later, secured a development deal with ABC.
Yep, kept pushing. In 2017, a deal with ABC for a show called The Mighty Quinn.
The Mighty Quinn.
Hmm.
And the theme, still in that same vein.
Exactly the same thematic vein, proving the consistency of her personal brand. The Mighty Quinn centered on a 39-year-old character named Quinn who decides to take a full year off from dating after being dumped on Christmas Day.
Ouch. Christmas Day.
Rough, right. But both Jen and The Mighty Quinn, they're really case studies in how a comic tries to monetize and, well, fictionalize the observational material that made them famous. And also how challenging it is to get that specific kind of niche observational comedy approved for a network pilot.
Yeah, that jump seems tough.
Yeah.
But maybe the most surprising and arguably prestigious role, the one that truly shows the industry's respect for her technical comedic skill, was her work on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Oh, absolutely. This role is arguably the highest validation of her pure craft. She contributed to seasons 1 and 2 in 2017 and 2018 as a writer, consultant, and producer.
Okay, so multiple hats there. What was her specific responsibility?
It wasn't just general advice. It was specialized, highly technical work, providing many of the actual jokes for the main character, Midge Maisel's stand-up routines.
Wow. So she was applying her deep understanding of modern observational comedy to write in-character, period-appropriate jokes for a fictional 1950s comic. That feels like a huge technical leap.
It is. It's like the ultimate test of comedic architecture, isn't it?
Yeah.
You have to essentially remove your modern sensibility, your personal voice, the very things that made her a bestseller, and adapt to the joke structure, the societal constraints, the cadence of the late 1950s and early 1960s.
Incredible.
And the context just deepens this. The series, created by Amy Sherman Palladino, is loosely based on the early career of Joan Rivers.
Right.
A comedian Kirkman specifically cites as a primary influence.
Wow, that is genuinely full circle. Writing for a character who kind of embodies the spirit of one of her own heroes.
Yeah, exactly. And it just confirms her value as a pure joke mechanic. You know, writing jokes that work for Midge Maisel requires an understanding of how funny works, structurally, independent of personal delivery. She actually returned to that specific stand-up consulting role again in 2021, proving that specialized skill set remains highly sought after in prestige TV.
Okay, so if we look at the whole picture, the totality of his career, the podcasting universe seems like the place where she maintains the most consistent, maybe intimate connection with her audience, like a weekly audio diary almost.
Yeah, I think that's fair. It's sort of a foundational pillar that allows her to completely bypass the network filtering process, right?
Hmm.
Her current weekly podcast is called No Fun, but its name has evolved over time. It was previously I seem fun, and before that, having funlessness.
Okay.
The title shifts themselves kind of reflect that self-deprecating, often anxious tone of her observational humor.
And she was a pretty vital part of that whole early alt-comedy podcast movement, too, wasn't she?
Oh, yeah, definitely. She was a regular guest on the Crab Feast podcast.
Right. Love the Crab Feast.
And notably, a real fixture on the monthly Pod F Tompcast with Paul F. Tompkins.
VFT.
Yeah. That association with Tompkins is significant because that's where she got the nickname Sophie.
Ah, the Boston roots again.
Exactly. A clear reference to her Massachusetts background, which she seems to carry as a badge of honor. These appearances really solidify her position within the comedy community. They provided this unscripted, long-form platform that allowed for much deeper explorations of personal themes than, you know, a quick panel segment ever could.
And that intimacy probably directly fuels the material she later formalizes in her books and specials.
Absolutely. It's all connected.
Now let's dig into the core comedic DNA a bit more. Who influenced this highly personal observational style that's often, you know, tinged with a bit of melancholy? The list is a fascinating mix.
It really is. The cited influences range pretty widely. Joan Rivers, Howard Stern, Roseanne Barr, Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, David Spade.
Quite a spectrum there.
Yeah, and what's critical is the blend. You've got the high-energy, almost shout-driven comics like Stern and Rivers,
yeah,
combined with the masterful, precise observationalists like Chappelle and Rock. This kind of explains her stage presence, which can be both intensely intimate and highly animated at the same time.
But there's that anecdote about her childhood TV habits that really seems to crystallize how she found her unique voice, that permission to be intense on stage.
Oh, absolutely. That story is key. As an 8-year-old, she'd sneak out to a friend's house just to watch uncensored Sam Kinison and George Carlin comedy specials on HBO.
Wow, at 8. Okay.
Yeah. And she recounted that really formative moment watching Kinison, realizing someone is yelling, "I'm not in trouble," and it's funny.
Huh. That's a great line.
Isn't it? That idea of transmuting inappropriate or intense emotional energy into safe, palatable humor that became like a cornerstone of her stage persona. It gave her license to be highly reactive, even anxious, in her stand-up delivery.
And then there's the truly unexpected influence. Maybe the most revealing one.
Morrissey, yes. She has cited the lead singer of the Smiths as perhaps her single greatest influence.
Morrissey, really?
She admits she's nothing like him personally, right? But she credits him specifically with providing the model for the ability to say morbid things with a sense of humor.
Okay, I can sort of see that connection now.
Yeah, this connection is paramount, I think, to understanding her observational style. It explains why her stand-up often includes that dark, self-deprecating edge, managing to be melancholic and hilarious simultaneously. She basically took the thematic structure of the lament, which is such a hallmark of the Smiths, and applied it to the personal anxiety of modern life.
Fascinating link. Now, we've touched on how her personal life informs her material, but the marriage and subsequent divorce, that provided a really clear, monetizable case study, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. She married writer and director Neil Mahoney in August 2009, and the marriage dissolved fairly quickly. They divorced in 2011. The significant factor here is the public nature of the announcement. She revealed she was no longer married on the August 25, 2011 episode of Chelsea Lately.
On the show itself.
On the show itself. Utilizing her platform to break the news directly to her audience.
That choice to share such intimate news on what's essentially a celebrity gossip show, that feels like a strategic move in itself. It immediately turned a private event into public professional material.
It's the ultimate professionalization of vulnerability, isn't it?
Yeah.
The divorce immediately became the central subject explored directly in her subsequent memoir and stand-up specials. The sources absolutely confirm that this highly personal material, the divorce, the trials of dating after, the choice not to have children, this became the most successful and critically acclaimed work she produced. She truly mastered the art of transmuting personal experience into marketable material across multiple platforms. She made her life the central engine of her entire output.
So if we try to synthesize all these different moves, the club circuit grind, the failed pilots, the bestseller status, the technical consulting on Maisel, what is the key takeaway about the architecture of Jen Kirkman's career?
Well, I think her trajectory demonstrates a really profound understanding of creative leverage. She didn't just find success in one lane, right?
Yeah.
She ensured that every piece of her intellectual property, her comedic voice, her personal anecdotes, her political observations could be successfully packaged and repackaged as stand-up, as a best-selling book, as a pilot concept, even as outsourced consulting material.
That's adaptability.
It is. She's that rare comic who is equally adept at writing the raw, immediate joke for a club audience and providing the structural backbone for a fictional TV show character decades removed from her own experience. She leveraged a strong, singular voice into genuine creative control over her output.
That specific pivot you mentioned, from performing her own material, material rooted so specifically in her life, like the divorce or the child-free choice,
mm-hmm.
to actively consulting and writing period-appropriate jokes for a fictional character like Midge Maisel, that feels like the definitive moment of technical mastery.
I agree. And it raises a powerful question, I think, for you, the listener, to kind of mull over long after this deep dive is complete.
Okay.
If the source material shows that a writer's greatest strength is their observational depth and their deep personal connection to the material, what does it actually take, emotionally, technically, stylistically, to successfully translate that unique, deeply personal voice into outsourced, high-quality, applicable jokes for someone else?
Mm.
It moves beyond just being funny yourself, you know? It requires understanding the structural mechanics of comedy so incredibly well that you can apply your knowledge to almost any context, any character, any era.
The ultimate sign of a comedic architect, maybe? A blueprint that works on stage, on the page, and yeah, on prestige television. That's a wrap on our deep dive into Jen Kirkman's versatile and truly masterful career.